KZSU FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor at the Charlotte School of Law. Today, I'm very excited to have on Matt Mason, the author of a new book, The Pirate's Dilemma, How Youth Culture is Reinventing Capitalism. We've had a number of guests on the history of Hearsay Culture that have discussed issues involving piracy and intellectual property and commons management and issues involving new theories of innovation, like Henry Chesbrough's views of open innovation, people that have very dim views of intellectual property rights and believe that intellectual property rights ultimately are an impediment to the forward motion of society, and others that feel that we need stronger IP than exists, and things like fair use are subject to too much abuse and ultimately encourage piracy. Matt's book, The Pirate's Dilemma, How Youth Culture is Reinventing Capitalism, is really a very wide-ranging study and look at a variety of situations in which piracy, and we're going to talk about what that means, is impacting how entertainment is created, how entertainment is distributed, how products are developed, and indeed how our culture is viewed. The book itself, which is published by Free Press, is written in a somewhat unusual way, and we're going to discuss it a bit at the beginning of the interview, but the way that Matt approaches this topic is by looking at different situations in which piracy or new forms of creation have arguably interfered or certainly disrupted business models and the traditional methods that we expect to come out of the economy with respect to issues like distribution or innovation or product development, product control, and expansion. So one of the topics we're going to be talking about is a phrase that Matt uses in a book, what he calls punk capitalism. And it's a very interesting theory, and the antecedents of it, and indeed its underpinnings, are quite unusual. Pirate's Dilemma is also an interesting book because I think it's one of those books that is written for a wide audience. It's oftentimes on Hearsay Culture, we have authors on, or we have law professors on, who are writing works that are not designed or written necessarily for the general public. They're written for a different audience, or they are written at a certain level that you need to have a strong background in a particular area to understand the nuances. The Pirate's Dilemma is different because it is written for a broader audience, but it's also, I think, very accessible and interesting to people that have a background in this area. So before we start with Matt, of course, by way of brief background, and again to give you an idea of the somewhat unusual nature of the book as well as its author, Matt began his career as a pirate radio and club DJ in London, and went on to found and become editor-in-chief of the seminal magazine RWD. In 2004, he was selected as one of the faces of Gordon Brown's Start Talking Ideas campaign, and was presented the Prince's Trust London Business of the Year Award by HRH Prince Charles. So, again, an unusual background even there with respect to the kinds of issues we've been discussing on Hearsay Culture. He's written and produced TV series, comic strips, viral videos, and records, and his journalism has appeared in various publications, including Adweek and Complex and publications throughout the globe. So I'm very excited to have Matt on, and hopefully I've done my logistical job properly here. Matt, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Good to be here, Dave. Thank you.
Let's start right off with really that background question that I ask really all of my guests. So really a little bit more, I've discussed a little bit of your background, but more of your background and why you decided to write The Pirate's Dilemma.
Well, it was interesting. I mean, I grew up in London, as you said, involved in pirate radio as a pirate radio DJ from my teens into my early 20s. But even when I was younger, even when I was sort of 8, 9, 10, I really started to get interested in pirate radio. And I was, first of all, I was interested because, you know, some of my friends' older brothers and sisters were DJs and parts of these stations. It's kind of different over here. We don't have pirate radio in the same way in the States that you have it in the UK. In the UK, it's flourished in a different way. A lot of these pirate radio stations are going concerns. They make money, they have advertisements on all the record labels, advertise on pirate stations, even though they're illegal. The police in London advertise on the pirate stations because they command, they have a huge audience. They have 10% of the city listen to the pirates. It's where the kids are getting their lots of their information and certainly getting their new music. So at a young age, I was always very interested just in the kind of concept of pirate radio, because I wasn't a kid who got in lots of trouble. I didn't do lots of things that were illegal, but I could see that this was clearly good for society. It was encouraging my friends to not be on the street and to be DJing and buying records and making records. It was just encouraging and engendering community, and that always really interested me. And then one of my good friends, he made a record on his computer and this tiny keyboard, and I watched him make it in a couple of hours, and the next thing it hits the top 10 pop charts in the space of a few months. And this is when we were about 15, and that was just, I was like, this is crazy. Like, this doesn't make any sense. This thing is totally illegal, and it's this opportunity, and it's creating all this new music and all this new culture. So I grew up thinking the word piracy had very, very different connotations to me than it does to most people. And this fascination with this relationship between how the underground and the mainstream feed each other, it was an unhealthy obsession. It informed all lots of the decisions I made. I studied economics, and I was a pirate radio DJ the whole time I was doing that in Bristol in the west of England. And I was thinking a lot about the economics of piracy all the time I was doing that. And I ended up going to work at Atlantic Records and eventually into advertising and then into the magazine business before starting my own magazine, Rewind, with four other guys. And I was just always, by the time we started Rewind, it was really this idea coming together of we started this very glossy, aspirational magazine that was given away free, but we charged a lot more than our competitors in terms of advertising rates because we could absolutely prove that we had the ear of the audience. The same way pirate radio is out there and it's free and it's kind of, it's not in the shops, it's on the underground, but it attracts large advertisers and stuff. And that was our business model. We based the idea for the magazine on kind of on a pirate radio station, how that worked. And that worked out pretty well, and then the business grew and we started to get a lot of attention nationally, and it's still one of the biggest urban music magazine in the UK today, and I'm really proud of what we were able to accomplish. But at that point, once Rewind had grown and I'd outgrown Rewind, I decided that I needed to really write this down. I needed to think about this idea because I'd always been sort of very focused on what it meant in terms of my life and London and music and culture and starting a magazine and DJing and these things that interested me. But as time went on, it became clear that these issues of piracy and unconventional ways to think about sharing and redistributing and repurposing information were affecting everything. They're affecting everything in the era of the internet. And so I started looking at areas where piracy had really helped, moved other things along, and it helped, and where it wasn't helping, and why it made things change, and why it didn't, what didn't help. And I realized there was a good idea for a book there, and that's really how it all came to pass.
And your background, being someone that's been on the business side of these issues, I think helps inform your discussion. You did mention at the beginning that pirate radio doesn't have the same influence, perhaps, or certainly hasn't been as big of an influence in the United States. And I think it would be helpful for listeners who aren't as familiar with these issues. I mean, of course, you're on the opposite of a pirate radio station on KZSU, licensed by the FCC, operating within its rules, operating totally legally. What is, in terms of your definition, just in order to understand the context, what is the nature and what are the parameters roughly of pirate radio as you understood it in England?
Well, so the difference is not just that you don't have a license and you're not legal.
Right.
It comes down to just the way you operate and the way that the station is set up. I mean, most legal radio stations have a studio and presenters and a certain format, and everything's done in a fairly structured way. And there's certainly structure on the pirates in the UK, but it's not at the same level. So, whereas instead of being in a studio, you'll be in a disused apartment in top of a tower block, somewhere in a London. Sometimes the turntables will be set up in a kitchen next to the sink. I've DJed from people's bedrooms. Once I was DJing from two turntables set up on an ironing board in someone's living room. And somebody was living there at the time. And
I'm sure they enjoyed it.
Sorry.
No, I said, I'm sure they enjoyed having you there on the ironing board.
Yeah, I think, the 24/7 pirate station, I think it kind of got on their nerves after a while. And it's really, a lot of the time, you might have an MC with you, but a lot of the time, it's just you and the turntables, and then you've got a cell phone. And you read out the number, and listeners call in and do shouts and dedications and ask for requests and rewinds and all these things, and you get listeners from all over the world because people start streaming the signal via the net, and suddenly you're getting calls from Sweden and Brazil, and you can't work out why. But the way that you transmit in London is really, really lo-fi. You have a transmitter, an aerial, on a neighbouring rooftop. You never have the transmitter where the studio is, and they're connected using an infrared link, which can't be detected by the Department of Trade and Industry, who send out detector vans to take down the pirate stations. That they can find the signal strong enough from your radio transmitter, they can find that. But they can't. There's no way they can accurately detect the infrared signal.
Hmm.
So that's how you transmit, you have the speakers plugged into. In the studio, you're not listening to yourself in the studio. You don't have monitors plugged into the studio. You have the monitors tuned into your signal on the radio, so you're listening to yourself through the radio. And the reason you do that is because if the Department of Trade and Industry, which I guess is the equivalent of the FCC here, if they do find your transmitter, they will literally go up to the top of the tower block and take it down. And as soon as they're up there, they can see which way the link box is pointing, and they can work out which tower block you're in. So as soon as the signal goes dead, it'll go dead in the studio, and that's your cue to get out of the area as quickly as possible as a DJ.
So it serves as a rudimentary security system for the operators of the station.
Yeah. It is, and what's very interesting, and this was something that really interested me about pirate radio in the UK. Once I got involved in it, you hear sort of the official line from the Department of Trade and Industry and the UK government and the police is pirate radio is bad; it needs to be wiped out at all costs. But the guys on the street in the detector vans and the guys who run the pirate radio stations, I mean, they all know each other. And they all have a certain admiration and respect for each other. And the DTI don't treat the pirate stations as criminals, and the pirate station owners don't treat the DTI like police. I mean, the owners of the stations that I was on, I used to play on London's two biggest pirate radio stations. I mean, they knew who the guys in the DTI vans were. I mean, they'd had meetings with these guys. These guys had their numbers. They would call them and say, "Listen, we're gonna hit you today. We're gonna take down the station. Please, can you just stay off air just for the rest of the day, just so we look like we're doing our job?" Conversations like this went on all the time, and it's really a game of it's people think of it as a game of cat and mouse, but it's really more of a game of whack-a-mole, because as soon as you knock one transmitter down, another one pops up on another tower block. I mean, these things cost. You can start a pirate radio station for about $600. And if you're making a couple of thousand dollars every weekend on ad revenue from the station, and you're making even more money by putting on club nights, which you advertise on your own station, and if you run a small record label as well, and you sell, there's so many revenue streams that can come from a pirate radio station, that you can literally have a lockup under a railway arch full of transmitters and aerials and rigs and turntables, and as soon as one operation gets hit, you just launch it again somewhere else. So we were always up, and it was always on, and the DTI, they don't throw the resources that they need to combat that problem for two reasons. One, because they don't, I mean, it's not that much of a priority. People like pirate radio. So you've got the support of the community for it. People like it. But the other area where there's support for pirate radio, which people don't get, is from commercial radio stations and record labels. Because pirate radio benefits both of these legitimate businesses. Commercial radio stations hire the most popular DJs from pirate radio stations, even though they're not supposed to by law. That's where they get lots of their new DJs, and they've done that for decades. And also the record labels and the radio stations have the pirates to thank for a lot of the music they play. When a tune gets really, really big on the pirates, well, then that's when it starts to get rotated on commercial radio stations. And that's how a kid getting one record on a pirate station is able to then hit the top of the pop charts. And this happens regularly in the UK. It's one of the reasons that so many styles of dance music have really mutated there, because you don't have the opportunity to do that with most commercial radio stations. You have strict parameters about what you can and can't play. If you're a commercial station, you've got a lot of commercial pressures, and the best thing to do, unfortunately, is to play the same 20 records 20 times a day. I mean, it's just the reality of commercial radio. Mm-hmm. It's not the reality of pirate radio. Pirates, the most popular pirates tend to be the ones who are really pushing the envelope musically, who are being the most experimental, who are trying to push new scenes and new sounds. That's what that audience really likes. And the huge parallel for me between pirate radio and the way the rest of entertainment media, especially and news media, all kinds of media seems to be moving, is that we now have lots of areas like this where individuals and citizens can broadcast a signal of their own, can offer an alternative to the mainstream signal. You don't have to be a pirate radio DJ anymore, you just have to have an internet connection. And you can do something cool, and you can do it in all kinds of areas, and it's adding value to all these other areas. And so this is the reason I look at all these different forms of creativity going on. I look at them through the lens of piracy, because from my perspective, it was kind of the same thing as pirate radio. It was a bunch of kids deciding to do something because it was cool, and even though it wasn't necessarily legal, it turned out it was cool.
And you know, it's funny, as I hear you describe this, of course I think of the various DJs at KZSU who may be thinking, wait a minute, I can grab some equipment and run this out of my apartment. KZSU, of course, you know, the big difference, especially when dealing with the internet, of course, is at least at this point, the general absence of regulation for non-radio station streams, and you know, particularly the podcast world and other internet radio, which is slowly developing in the United States, although there's been issues with royalties and the payments attendant to them here. But it's a fascinating background, and really I think it gets us to discuss the book in a little more detail, because and I guess I'll ask a two-part question here. So you make the point in the book early on of describing what your title means, and importantly for those that haven't seen the book, when we say the pirate's dilemma, you have the apostrophe after the E, so you're referring to the individual pirate as opposed to the pirates as a group, and perhaps the title, you know, certainly could be interpreted differently if it were written that way to suggest the impact of pirates on the world generally, which is something you do discuss. But you title the book "The Pirate's Dilemma," with pirate being possessive. So, you know, I'll ask you why and what you mean by that, which ties in really to a basic question about a thesis of this book.
Yeah. So there's sort of two reasons I did that. One, because I took the inspiration from the framework for the Pirate's Dilemma from the economic model, the game theory model of the Prisoner's Dilemma. But in the Prisoner's Dilemma, for the audience, those in the audience who are not familiar with this, it's a thought experiment, a game used, the economists use to work out or to illustrate how how people make decisions based on the decisions they think other people will make. And the game is these two prisoners who are caught for a robbery, and the police can't prove they did it. They put them in two different rooms and try and get them both to confess, and threaten them with, well, if you confess and your friend doesn't, then you'll go free and he'll get 10 years, and vice versa. And if you both don't confess, then, well, we can only give you 6 months for stolen goods. And if you both do confess, well, then you'll both get a reduced sentence. So it's this game. And in that game, the prisoner does own the dilemma. And it might have been better from a marketing point of view to call this book The Pirate's Dilemma. People look at that and like, hang on a sec, why is this The Pirate's Dilemma? It's not right. The Pirate's Dilemma because, well, I'm not the pirate. Right. And the point of the book is you are the pirate. Like, there isn't it's not an us and them situation anymore. When you're thinking about the control and the flow of information, I don't think it's helpful to think about, okay, so I own this and I get to decide what happens to it, this piece of information. Because a lot of the time you don't get to decide. As much as I believe in intellectual property rights and copyrights and patent laws, I make my living from intellectual property, I realize it needs to be protected. I disagree with the notion that I can stop someone stealing it, because it's becoming harder and harder to do that. This is happening in all kinds of industries. And I just wanted to sort of take away this boundary in people's heads about what it means to be a pirate, what piracy means, and the connotations, which is kind of, it's an uphill struggle to try and to use the word pirates and try and convince people that there's a positive thing there. But right. I've been trying.
Well, it's certainly a challenging goal, because there's no question that when you see policy debates existing, or at least the United States, but also in Europe, and you see discussions of changing intellectual property law to allow greater flexibility of derivative and transformatory uses of copyrighted materials. Anyway, usually the first caveat that anyone espousing those views gives is, of course, piracy is wrong. And so the word piracy is ultimately a synonym for theft. And so you are, you know, you are using the word a little bit differently. And so that perhaps we can explore it this way and work in theses that come out of the book by asking you about one of the phrases that I mentioned in the introduction, which is this phrase punk capitalism. And I think it really also brings for listeners that haven't seen the book, gives a very strong idea, in addition to your background as a pirate DJ, the perspective that you're bringing to this analysis. What is punk capitalism? And if you would, explain the three ideas that you identify with reference to capitalism and innovation that you derive from the punk rock movement.
Well, the term punk capitalism, it's not something that I coined. The first people I heard say it were, I wrote for a few years for a magazine called Vice Magazine, which is big over here and in the UK and in lots of, actually all over the world now. But the three founders of Vice Magazine, three old punk rockers from Canada, and that's always their kind of thing. That's what they called Vice. That's what they called what they did. They were creating this product that they hoped would upset people and change things and do stuff more than just make money, which to more or less extent it has over the years. Bono also used the term punk capitalism when he was launching Product Red. And so I looked at that idea, but it was really, I kind of wanted to define the term. What does punk capitalism mean? What is this? Because it's kind of a redundant term. It's kind of an oxymoron. But it's not. If you look at the history of punk, punk was always about capitalism. Well, certainly in terms of the early big punk bands, they were all signed to major labels and all the rest of it. But, I mean, other movements have developed that are certainly not about capitalism from punk. But I really, it just seemed to fit with me, these three things that I saw going on that were allowing piracy to become the problem and the solution that it has become today. The first thing is this ability to do it yourself. This thing that was the core thesis of punk was that you do everything yourself. You play the guitar yourself, even if you can only play three chords. In fact, it was better if you could only play three chords. You didn't need to be able to sing. You made your own clothes. You started your own record label. You started your own fanzine. Everything was do it yourself. And punk really pushed this idea. And this idea of producing as much as you consume, which is becoming a real reality of the way, certainly the generation growing up now, the idea of media and how we interact with it and what we expect from it and what we expect to do with it. This idea of do-it-yourself, I mean, it was always, it's been something that's been growing. Passive media is less exciting to people these days. You can do so much more with a turntable than you can with a CD player, or you can do so much more with a laptop than you can with a TV. And whereas doing stuff yourself has always been a great way to kind of vent. And this was the other thing about punk. It was very big on resisting authority. And if you combine this do it yourself ethic with the desire to resist, that's creating some really cool stuff. And back in the 70s, if you were bored, if there was nothing good on television and you were just frustrated with the way society was going, well, there were only so many ways you could vent. And a good way to vent was to start a band like the Sex Pistols and dye your hair and cut up your clothes and shout about it. And if you were lucky, if you were one of the lucky ones, then you know, you might get signed and you might become a big band. Well, these days, if there's nothing good on TV, if you're not happy with the way the mainstream media is going, or you're not happy with your choices in terms of media, and you're three guys in your 20s, starting a punk band isn't the only choice. You can start right. a site like YouTube, and if you're really lucky, you'll sell it to Google in under 2 years later for $1.65 billion.
Right.
And so it's kind of the same, you know, the parameters are similar, but the stakes are higher. And music is no longer the only way we have to rebel. So this idea of do-it-yourself and rebellion together are really giving us opportunities to change things in ways that we haven't been able to do before. And the last part of punk capitalism, the part that guys like Bono are very big on, is this idea of purpose being as important as profit. And we're seeing that happen in a number of businesses, where people are starting a business where the purpose, their whole purpose and mission statement is integral to every part of the product. It's their advertising campaign. It's everything. American Apparel is driven by this idea of sweatshop free clothes and being very sort of advocating that as a cool thing. And then we have lots of companies. I mean, even companies that aren't driven by purpose at least have to pretend to be driven by purpose mm-hmm. in this day and age, because everything's so much more transparent. You have to, and advertising is not as effective as it once was. It's so easy to tune adverts out. We're hit with 5,000 of them a day. We're so much more savvy about media, and we can see through things that aren't true. So companies are really trying to, the way to get ahead and to beat the competition is to really push things that matter to people, is to push social things. And this is why we have things like, as much as it's the reason we have lots of cool companies like, I don't know, Patagonia or Ethos Water, it's also why we have large oil companies spending their entire advertising budget telling people how green they are. Mm-hmm. It's this idea that you really have to stand for something. And that's something that this purpose before profit thing is something that punk really pushed on the world. And interestingly enough, there were just as many contradictions within that notion in punk as there are in capitalism.
And certainly, we're gonna discuss some of those contradictions after a short break. You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU FM Stanford in discussion with Matt Mason, the author of the new book, The Pirate's Dilemma, How Youth Culture is Reinventing Capitalism. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, whether through podcasts or live on KZSU, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its broad base of programming. If you're interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can go to KZSU's webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Or alternatively, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless of which option you choose, and I do hope that you choose one, I certainly hope that, more importantly, that you listen to KZSU and continue to enjoy its programming. So we'll continue discussion with Matt Mason, author of the books The Pirate's Dilemma, How Youth Culture is Reinventing Capitalism. You mentioned before that very short break, Matt, some of these contradictions, and we should look at them a little bit. And one way that we can take a look at it, perhaps, is you mentioned the history of Sealand, which is a story that a fair amount of people know, but I think certainly you could explain exactly what it is for people that don't. Upon discussing Sealand, I think the existence of Sealand raises a larger question, one that I do want to explore, which is the idea of piracy as a means to share knowledge that would otherwise not be shared because of the existence of command economies or closed societies or even just tight and strong IP protections. What's your view? First of all, if you would, for listeners, describe what Sealand is and how it fits into your theory. And then if you would, talk a little bit about piracy as a means of expanding knowledge bases and not just product innovation and products generally.
Did you say piracy is advancing knowledge?
Piracy as a form of ultimately not only advancing knowledge, but actually, I'll be more specific, allowing opportunities for people who otherwise would not get information to get it.
Right, okay. So to start with Sealand, I was fascinated with Sealand for a number of reasons. Sealand is a World War II era, it's a sea fort. It's actually a sunken barge, which is sunken out in the English Channel, and it was used in World War II to house artillery guns that would shoot down the Luftwaffe as they flew over the Thames estuary in towards London to bomb London during the Blitz. And it was I think it's 21 of these sea forts out in the Thames estuary in the English Channel. And they were all left by the Navy and the Army to rust and just fall into the sea after the war, which, of course, a lot of them didn't. A lot of them are still there, sort of 6-8 miles out to sea. And a lot of the pirate radio really sort of exploded in the UK in the 60s, and it started out in the English Channel. It started with people broadcasting on shortwave radio and AM radio in ships, and these old sea forts made great homes for pirate radio stations. And this one sea fort was, I think it was 8 miles off the coast of the UK, which back in the 60s, the international waters was, after 3 miles off the coast, you were in international waters. And this one pirate radio DJ who was broadcasting from another nearby sea fort started thinking about this and started thinking about, well, hang on a second, this sea fort isn't owned by or part of Great Britain. And he started digging around and talking to some lawyers about the possibilities of this place. And he realized he could claim it under international dereliction rights as his own territory, his own country. So he, in 1966, on Christmas Eve, he invaded or boarded Sealand boarded the sea fort and declared it Sealand and declared himself Prince Roy of Sealand. And he moved in with his family. He built a helipad on the top. He began printing coins and passports and stamps and selling stuff. And he lived on Sealand for a couple of decades, I think, all told. He now lives in Spain. He's retired. But the Sealand royal family still own this sea fort, and various things happen there. There's a data warehousing stuff going on there. It was badly damaged in a fire 2 years ago, which I think the island's still recovering from. But Sealand was really interesting to me, not just because it was this crazy story of an old C4 being turned into a radio station and then a nation. But it really illustrated to me what pirates do really well and what they do that's actually valuable for us as a society. And the thing they do well is they find gaps outside of the market. Whereas we're taught as entrepreneurs and business people, we look at the market, we look at the gaps in the market, and there are places where you cannot and should not go. And pirates, rightly or wrongly, stray outside these boundaries sometimes. They look at things that nobody else would have looked at in quite the same way. And sometimes this is bad. Like, I mean, this is the point of the book. The biggest misconception about the pirate's dilemma is that I'm advocating that all piracy is always good, which is not what I'm doing at all. Piracy is not always good. Piracy is quite often bad. It's not good for society. It's not good for anybody other than the pirate. And in those situations, the best way to combat piracy is to fight piracy in traditional ways, to throw lawsuits, to fight pirates in the courts, all of these things. I don't know, a good example would be last year Colgate Palmolive was facing a problem. Some pirates in China were manufacturing counterfeit Colgate toothpaste.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was this toothpaste was toxic. So they're shipping it all over the world, and this toothpaste is poisoning Colgate customers. I mean, there's no added value there for Colgate customers.
Right.
And there's certainly no value for Colgate. So that's that's a no-brainer. You fight piracy. But in some situations, when pirates go outside of the market, they create new possibilities. And Sealand is certainly an island, albeit an island the size of a basketball court. It's an island of possibilities. There's all kinds of ideas have been floated out there, if you'll pardon the pun. Intellectual property lawyers and lawyers who are interested in international issues of all kinds always use Sealand as a case study. Well, you know, how would this work on Sealand? There's lots of papers written about it. But Sealand wasn't the only country that was kind of founded on piracy. There's lots of countries which have come up by ignoring intellectual property rights, and it's actually been beneficial for society that those intellectual property rights were, for a period of time, and I must stress, for a period of time, ignored. Mm-hmm. America, when America industrialized, it was national policy to totally ignore international copyright laws, patents, trademarks, the same way that China is doing today. This really was why America wasn't able to industrialize as rapidly as it did, because it didn't have these high costs and they didn't have to pay all this money to the Europeans. Of course, this really annoyed lots of Europeans, many of whom began referring to Americans with the Dutch word Junke, meaning Little John, which was a Dutch slang word for pirate, which mm-hmm. we today pronounce a Yankee. So America really took advantage of piracy to industrialize. It's one of the reasons it was able to cement its place in the world as quickly as it did. And then within America, within American history, there are so many examples of people doing things that in the first instance caused an uproar and were labeled as a pirate, and people said that what they were doing was wrong. But in the long term, we look back at it and we can actually see that what they did added value to society. A great example is Thomas Edison. When Thomas Edison was developing the phonographic record player, lots of live musicians literally thought this was the end of the music business. This was going to destroy their livelihood. Here's this guy with this machine
right.
that can perfectly reproduce what they did live on these strange plastic spinning discs. I mean, why do you need a musician if you have this disc? They thought they'd only ever play one performance, and then everybody would just have a disc.
Hmm.
And they labeled Edison a pirate. Of course, Edison proved them wrong and started Edison Records, and the recording industry was born. And suddenly, all these musicians had a very, very healthy new revenue stream. But then Edison didn't kind of make this connection when he went on to be part of developing filmmaking. He tried to charge filmmakers a license fee for using his projector and his technology and all this stuff. And lots of the New York filmmakers really, really objected to this. They objected to that, well, they couldn't pay this fee. They thought it was too high. But they wanted to make films. They thought it was their right to be able to make films. So lots of these filmmakers fled to the West, which was then still fairly wild, away from Edison and his lawyers in New York, to this small town on the West Coast, which was fairly close to the Mexican border, so they could flee to Mexico if they did get word that Edison had dispatched a team of lawyers. And there's this small town full of pirate filmmakers, including a guy called William Fox, and that town was Hollywood, and Fox is now one of the biggest media companies in the world. And, I mean, there's tons of examples like this. If you look at the history of how broadcast radio started here, the history of cable TV here, you will find piracy in some shape or form at its beginnings. People at Stanford Law will know that Lawrence Lessig has talked about this a lot. You can see these examples of pirates pushing envelopes all over the world. And in many instances, in the first place, people look at what they're doing. So this is wrong. This is taking money from over here. But what they ignore is that it's creating new pools of money somewhere else. Another guy who's talked about this a lot in a book I borrowed the title from as well, in a well-released reference, was The Innovator's Dilemma by Clay Christensen. He talks about this when a disruptive technology happens, is created, it often shifts where the money is collected. It stops being collected from one place, but sometimes it will be collected in one or two or three other places as a result. And we're seeing this happen. The thing today that's different between in the age of the internet is, in previous times, it was kind of one industry getting disrupted at a time. But now we have this ultimate copying machine, and we can distribute all kinds of things electronically. We're seeing this problem in lots of different industries at once. And so the backlash, which I believe is going to be short term, is at a higher volume, because we can't see the woods for the trees yet. We're only just starting to see this in the record industry. I think in the next 2 or 3 years, it will become clear that there is a way to do digital distribution in a way that will actually mean the record business is much larger than it is now, and there will be more opportunities for artists to make money, and it will be fairer. It might not mean the four major record labels that exist today are as powerful as they once were, but it will mean that there's a healthy record industry.
The challenge that you have, and you identified it earlier, we're talking to Matt Mason, the author of The Pirate's Dilemma, here on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. The dilemma you mentioned earlier, and one that you do get out in front of in the book, is dispelling the notion that you're suggesting intellectual property rights don't have a role. But you do have, and your book lays out a number of problems that you identify with respect to intellectual property, and ultimately its role in large measure as an impediment to innovation. And I guess I want to ask you, you're talking about, what is a form of creation and a form of development that is under attack because there is piracy, as you identify clearly, that we don't want to have happen. What, if you could expand a little bit, what do you see as the role of intellectual property law in the really the pirate's dilemma? How do you see it fitting into the theory? And since we have about 10 minutes left, I'll ask you the secondary question, which really is, you mentioned towards the end of the book your four pillars of open source. And if you could tie that into your conclusion that pirates will move the economy forward, I think we could perhaps tie it together a little bit.
So I think the role of intellectual property law, the role of pirates, I think people's roles in this equation are all pretty clearly defined, and there's certainly some changes. There's some changes that I think would be really helpful to a lot of different intellectual property laws. I think things like the Creative Commons movement are incredible. It's just so incredible and so helpful to culture, as all kinds of culture. And I think the changes we need to see in intellectual property law are, in lots of areas, the real opportunity in intellectual property law is allowing people to do things and allowing people to pay for the privilege to do things in a way that's not being done in lots of areas today. There are so many things you cannot do with very everyday pieces of intellectual property that you can purchase anywhere, like a piece of music or a movie. I do lots and lots of speaking at the moment. That's kind of my main thing to promote the book, is I go around and I do conferences and corporate speaking gigs. And I talk a lot about music. I talk a lot about music in my speeches. And I know lots of speakers, lots of presenters use music when they're in presentations, but I wanted to be extra careful because, I'm talking about piracy and I love to bash the RIAA and the music industry. I thought, well, I don't want these guys to come after me. I'm going to make sure I do everything by the book.
Good idea.
I pay for the right to use snippets of certain, old punk tracks and old hip-hop tracks, just tiny, like, 10-second snippets. It's all I need to use just to kind of illustrate some of the things I'm talking about. And I spoke to a friend of mine who's the vice president at ASCAP about this. I talked to the president of my speakers bureau. I looked high and low for an answer. It is impossible for me to pay to do this. I can't do this. I would love to pay the recording industry and the artists whose music I want to use so I can include those snippets of music in my keynotes. But I cannot do it. However, if I do it, there is a huge legal infrastructure set up so that people can come after me. Lots of companies, when you go in to talk to them, they'll make you sign an indemnification waiver thing that says that you're indemnifying up them for up to $1 million in damages just in case you did use a snippet of music you weren't supposed to, or just in case you did use a picture that you weren't supposed to. There are armies of bloodthirsty lawyers out there waiting to sue people for things like this, and things like the infrastructure around suing soccer mums and suing homeless people for downloading music is incredible. But if you look at the effort that's been put into trying to allow people to do things and trying to create a framework where people can legally do things with intellectual property that are so easy for people to do illegally, they're just not there in many cases. The future of growing intellectual property and encouraging and helping people to create and innovate and earn money from their creations is by allowing people to... Media has become so malleable, and you can't fight that with lawsuits. The only thing to do is to let people do it and to give them an option to do it legally. I mean, so many people will tell you that they download music a lot of the time out of the sheer frustration of not finding it on iTunes or it not being compatible with this or that or having certain restrictions. Or so many people go out looking for pieces of media that they cannot get legally, mm-hmm. and then they find them on a BitTorrent site. And, I mean, it's ridiculous. And you have the music industry and all these people saying, well, we can't figure it. It's going to take years to figure out a system where we could really do this, and everybody can get paid. And how come groups of Swedish teenagers can figure out this distribution problem? I don't understand. Like, the money component doesn't seem like it would be that tough to implement. We can get royalties from broadcast radio performances, and the metadata is not there at the same level in broadcast radio in the way it is with online transactions like downloads and streams. It's ridiculous. I mean, so in terms of where intellectual property needs to go, I think we need intellectual property laws. There are times when you definitely need to be fighting pirates, absolutely. But we need to recognize that we don't have that power as a society over individuals anymore to stop them doing certain things. And furthermore, why should we? Why shouldn't I be allowed to use these snippets in my presentation? You know, why shouldn't somebody be able to make a home video using a piece of Star Wars? I mean,
well, let me jump in, Matt, and let me ask you to push back a little bit, and I hear where you're going. But one response to that statement is simply the right of the author to control a work that he or she created. I mean, there's some writing being done in intellectual property. Professor Bobby Qualls, a professor at the Paul Law School, is writing about this. In fact, she was on the show a few weeks ago. You know, talking about the notion of personhood being more important in intellectual property than the U.S. allows. In other words, that an author should have the right to control his or her work because that's an extension of themselves. How do you respond to that concern in light of your strong position that ultimately one shouldn't be prevented from using these snippets in a way that you propose?
No, I do. I agree with that. I think creators should have should be able to exert control over their work, certainly for a period of time. You know, their lifetimes, for example, would be a fair period of time. But that's not really. I mean, I think that's a separate issue. I think that's. I don't really have any problems with that. My problem is with it's not really with the creators. It's with the middlemen between the creators and the consumers. The consumers are also creators and also have the opportunity and the technology to create stuff using the original piece of intellectual property. But what we have as a society is it's also an attitude. It's a change in attitudes rather than just laws as well. Is we have this attitude that the knee-jerk reaction is to say no a lot of the time. It's to be, okay, well, you can't use that because that's mine. Mm-hmm. And yes, you have the right to say that because that's yours, but if someone's going to do it anyway, if there's absolutely no way you can stop somebody from doing that, then that is the reality. You can't stop people from creating user-generated content with other people's stuff. They were doing it before. It's only a problem now because we have this incredible distribution channel, and that piece of user-generated content can get as far as the piece of broadcast content. But the problem is we're not recognizing that this is happening anyway, and that there could be an opportunity to earn more money. I mean, I think there is going to be a change in attitude, and I think we're starting to see it happen in the music industry, which was the first industry to really grapple with this problem. Whereas artists are now just kind of, a lot of artists have gone on the record about this, and Trent Reznor from the Nine Inch Nails and so on, talking about, you know, okay, the other ways they can earn money and you know, why downloading isn't such a problem. But a lot of artists off the record will tell you the same thing, and they won't go on the record because they don't want to annoy their record companies. But, I mean, it's just people are just figuring out new ways to earn money, and lots of times they're earning more money without the record company than they are with the record company, which is why the record company is trying to do these 360 deals now where they pull money from areas they're not really investing in, like touring and T-shirts and stuff. But I mean, that's another issue. So, yeah, I think artists, yeah, I mean, intellectual property is definitely, it's a good thing. It's important. And I do think the artist should be able to exert some control over their work. But the artist should also have the opportunities and the options to sell that work in a number of different ways. Mm-hmm. And it's starting to happen. The record industry is starting to do this. I was at a conference a few months ago, and the boss of Sony BMG was there talking about Justin Timberlake having, I think it was, over 100 revenue streams now. Hmm. Justin Timberlake as an artist, CDs is one of his revenue streams, but he has over 100. And I think that's the future of a lot of businesses, where we used to have one way to make money, and it was fairly solid and reliable, and it all just depended on there being this bottleneck. And now that these bottlenecks have gone, that's created a problem, because in the short term, it looks like the artists and the distributors and everybody have completely lost control. But I think the long-term opportunity and solution is looking at this new landscape and looking at all the opportunities that are there. Once you take this bottleneck away, you create other ways for people to interact with your intellectual property. And while you should be able to control what does and doesn't happen with a piece of work with your name on it, I mean, it's just about seeing it as an opportunity as well. So my whole thing is just, we need to change our attitude to this. Mm-hmm. We need to just say, hang on a second, is this really a problem where we just chuck a lawsuit at somebody and hope it goes away, or do we really sort of figure out what's going on here? Because something is going on. Like, the nature of how information flows has changed, and it's not going to unchange. No matter how many lawsuits are thrown, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's changed. It's done. Now we've got to work out, what do we do next?
The author is Matt Mason, the book The Pirate's Dilemma, How Youth Culture is Reinventing Capitalism, from Free Press. Unfortunately, Matt, we're out of time. There's about a dozen follow-up questions that I would love to ask you, and so I'll certainly invite you back on Hearsay Culture to continue discussion at a future date. But before we go, for those that want to learn more about your work, obviously you have your book. Any other resources you might suggest?
You can visit my website, thepiratesdilemma.com. The book should also be up on the Pirate Bay at some point soon. It's coming. We're doing a legal free download of it
at
the end of May as well. So that's all going to be on through my website.
Well, definitely a principled distribution of a book called The Pirate's Dilemma. Matt, thank you for joining me today on KZSU's Hearsay Culture.
Thank you. Great talking to you, Dave.
The book is A Pirate's Dilemma by Matt Mason, and like I said, it's a far-reaching book and one of those many books and authors that we have on where I constantly struggle with the three-hour show block dilemma, one that I've described earlier and I don't need to go into again. There are a number of shows coming up on Hearsay Culture. You can find the schedule by going to hearsayculture.com and clicking on schedule. As always, you can catch the show not only on KZSU Live, but also through iTunes by going to the Center for Internet Society webpage through the podcast search engine. You can also find the show through the RSS feed on Stanford Center for Internet Society webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And of course, you can get all of the shows from hearsayculture.com. As always, I welcome your feedback and thoughts and ways the show can be improved and suggestions for guests. You can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. So I hope to hear from you. Thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture. Thank you for listening to KZSU. And please stay tuned to further programming on KZSU FM Stanford. Have a good day.